Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's start off with a number today, 192,000. That, according to the Labor Department, is how many jobs the economy added last month. Is it enough? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, April 4th, and so it was. Time again for the age-old ritual at 8:30 this morning, Washington time, when economists and financial journalists click refresh over and over again on the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. Yes, we got new jobs numbers today from the Labor Department, and the government says the unemployment rate is steady at 6.7%. We'll dig into that more in a few minutes, but first, everybody wants that number to be lower. How low should it fall for the economy to look healthy again? Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
I'm going to start us off with a little ludicrous.
How low can you go? How low can you go?
When it comes to the unemployment rate, the answer to how low can you go isn't zero. Give it up. It's impossible. There will always be people entering the workforce between jobs, so...
Well, that, you know, that is not a simple question.
Robert Polin is an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
To me, a fair definition of full employment in the United States today would be, you know, unemployment under 4%.
Economists disagree about the unemployment rate that means we've gotten to full employment. Some say it's 5.5%. Others say 2%. There's more agreement on what a world of full employment feels like. Randall Ray is an economics professor at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
The people who want a job, they're ready and willing to work, they will find a job.
It would be an economy where you can feel good about getting that next job.
Your children, when they leave school, can get jobs.
You'll be able to plan for the future a little better, maybe buy a house.
You don't have to take the worst jobs that come along just out of fear that you can't find something better.
Imagine that. In an economy of full employment, you, the worker, have more control because there are fewer people out there looking to replace you. Jared Bernstein is a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
When you're at full employment, you're in a situation where employers actually need to bid wages up to get and to keep the workers they need, even for low-wage workers.
At full employment, says Bernstein, we'd likely all get paid more. At the bottom, the middle, and the top of the pay scale. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
All right, all those questions about pay, how many people are employed right now, we're going to talk about them and a bunch of other stuff on 4 minutes of live radio we call the Weekly Wrap. Joining me today are Felix Salmon from Reuters. Hey, Felix.
Good afternoon.
And Catherine Rampell, columnist at the Washington Post. Hi, Catherine.
Hey.
So, Felix, let me start with you. I want to ask about those jobs numbers, 192,000 of them. And what do you make, a good unemployment report or not?
It's basically the same as we've been seeing for the past few months. We haven't had a really good employment report since I can remember. We've just had a steady, grinding, slow recovery in employment. And that's about, I think we've resigned ourselves to that. That's what we're going to have to make do with for the foreseeable future.
Catherine, you agree with that?
Yeah, I would say that's basically true. There were a couple of bright spots in the report. You did see the labor force participation rate tick up a little bit. That's the share of people who are of working age who are actually either working or looking for work. So that was a little bit encouraging. You saw the work week get a little longer, implying that maybe employers might be working their existing workers harder and might be willing to hire some more workers. But generally, you know, it's sort of more of the same.
I wanted to get your take on a book that came out earlier this week. Michael Lewis came out with his book on high-frequency trading, and it's caused something of a stir in some corners, I suppose. Felix, have you read it? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but what do you make of what's happened? What do you make of what's happened since?
I think what he's done is he's sparked a debate among a bunch of people who already knew exactly what they thought about these things. The people who didn't know generally agree with him because he's a very persuasive storyteller. The people who thought that high-frequency trading is an evil which needs to be stopped have all jumped on this book, and a lot of attorneys general and FBI and that kind of thing have taken the opportunity to say that they're looking at this and they might possibly bring some prosecutions at some point. But the debate, I don't think the debate has really become any more sophisticated as a result of this book.
Catherine, you're in Washington, and I know the Supreme Court handed down a big decision this week, another big campaign finance decision, sort of doing away with overall limits on contributions. And I wonder how big a deal you think that is.
I think it's a very big deal. If you look at the reasoning in the report, in the decision, it seems as if this might be sort of a guidepost for what might further come in this area. I know that there are some lawyers who have said, well, it looks like this might be the start of a bunch of decisions that would bring down limits in general on political donations, maybe limiting, basically further recognizing corporations' status as people and ability to give money. It seems like this might kind of open the floodgates to a bunch of other decisions that would further relax restrictions on political donations. So, yes, I think it's a very big deal.
And Felix, also in Washington, we had Mary Barra, the still newish CEO of General Motors, testifying before the House and the Senate as these recalls continue to mount. How did she do, and what has this sort of meant for General Motors' brand, do you think?
It's been horrible for General Motors. General Motors was this big lumbering car company, and then one of the great achievements of the Obama administration's first term was that they managed to put it through this bankruptcy, and it was meant to come out as a leaner, more efficient, more effective, better-run company. And I think everything we've heard in the past couple of weeks about the complete dysfunction in the senior ranks of General Motors has just proved that none of that seems to have worked.
Catherine, they've enlisted the help of Ken Feinberg to sort of help them through all of this. What do you make of that decision?
It seems like they recognize that they need some outside assistance at the very least. As Felix was saying, you know, what's really come out of a lot of this is that there's been a lot of dysfunction, the CEO has argued that, you know, we weren't deliberately trying to hide things from one another. We just have a lot of very siloed departments. Legal doesn't talk to business, doesn't talk to the engineering side, whatever. And so clearly they had a lot of structural problems if you don't think it was sort of conspired malfeasance, and maybe having some outside help and, you know, figure out how to get their act together would be actually beneficial both for the families that were affected and for the company itself.
All right. Catherine Rampell, columnist at The Washington Post, and Felix Salmon from Reuters, thank you guys very much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Stocks are down at the end of the week. We'll have more details when we do the numbers. What if every device from your refrigerator to your thermostat were smart? The idea being we humans wouldn't have to set the temperature or check to see if we've run out of milk because those devices would do that for us. There's a name for this. It's called the Internet of Things, and it's supposed to be seamless until it's not. And that brings us to the company Nest. It's decided to halt sales of its smart smoke alarm. The device has what's called a wave function. It's supposed to allow you to turn off false alarms, but it could, under certain circumstances, delay an alarm when there's an actual fire. So why is this all still so hard? Marketplace's Queena Kim tells us.
The simple answer is it's the early days for the Internet of Things. Jeremy Jake is the CEO of Snoopy, a company that develops sensors to detect water leaks in your home. He says right now the business landscape is like the Wild West.
And it's not at all clear who's going to win.
Jake says there are a lot of different startups producing almost as many varieties of software and hardware to power the Internet of Things. But these products don't always talk the same language. And that often means you have to start dealing with the human being in customer support.
What I would expect to happen, because it's happened in virtually every other industry, is you'll start to see consolidation occur and standardization will come.
When winners emerge, everyone in the industry starts speaking the same languages, the technology becomes more seamless, and so the helpline becomes less necessary. Or maybe not.
There's a gap between the promise of the technology and the messiness of the reality of our lives.
Jonathan Gaw is an analyst at IDC, and he points to the Nest thermostat, which he owns.
The promise of the Nest is that it recognizes movements within the household so it can adjust temperature accordingly.
But Gaw's thermostat is hidden behind a big screen TV, and so it can't monitor movements. Tony Costa is an analyst at Forrester, and he says companies need to start adjusting expectations.
consumer electronic companies are used to developing devices. If something goes wrong with them, you know, it might ruin your day. So if your iPhone crashes, you know, it's kind of a bummer.
But if your fire alarm crashes, that could be fatal. Costa says these companies are known for pushing the envelope. But when it comes to wiring our lives, they might want something less glitzy and more dependable. Or maybe just a human who can help them out. In San Francisco, I'm Queenie Kim for Marketplace.
The multi-million-dollar question in the media world is who will get David Letterman's time slot when the big man steps down as host of The Late Show with David Letterman sometime next year. Letterman announced he plans to do that last night. There's also the question of who will be the house band on Dave's successor's show. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports from New York on what getting that gig can mean.
When Letterman announced his retirement on the show, the on-air reaction was quick.
Wow. Well, do I have a minute to call my accountant? Because
bandleader Paul Schaefer made a fortune playing sidekick and enduring cracks about his Canadian heritage. The exposure he got could open doors for him after the show ends.
It can enhance your chances of being successful at whatever it is that you want to do, simply because a lot of people know who you are now.
Kevin Eubanks was Jay Leno's longtime bandleader. Getting a slot like that isn't easy. They just don't come up that often.
Jay and I, for instance, we just got along. So sometimes it could just be something that simple, that, oh, these two people get along, and that would make for good TV.
Music industry analyst Bob Lefsetz points out that it's about more than band leaders. Behind them are working musicians trying to make a good living in a tricky industry. A job on a talk show can be a welcome break.
If you can get a gig on a late-night show, get paid every night, sleep in your own bed, it's very appealing.
And when you tour, you could play bigger venues. But late-night opportunities are shrinking, says Bill Carter, author of several books on late-night TV.
Frankly, one of the things I think you might see is a condensed band, because they have tighter budgets than they used to, and the bands are expensive.
But don't look for them to disappear. They play a vital role you don't see on TV. Eubanks says bands are crucial for keeping the studio audience hyped up.
The audience has all this energy because we gave it to them during the commercial that they want to release it, because, I mean, they're there to have a party.
And there's now a chance for another band leader to join it. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up, the Hard Rock Cafe gets a makeover.
They're hoping that they can keep people interested in the Hard Rock brand by, you know, keeping them at their hotels, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and then in their older years to come to the casinos.
Love all, serve all, eating, sleeping, and gambling, Hard Rock Cafe style. But first, let's do the numbers. What seemed like a good week ended nastily. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 159 points, 0.9%, ending at 16,412. The NASDAQ slashed 110 points to close at 4,127. And the S&P 500 cut 23 points, 1.25%, to finish at 1,865. For the week, the Dow gained 0.5%, the NASDAQ lost 0.6%, and the S&P 500 added 0.4%. Grubhub had its IPO, and shares of the online food delivery service closed more than 30% above the offering price. Tech generally took a slide. Microsoft was down 2.75%. Apple shed 1.25%. European markets were up. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.73%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. The Federal Reserve releases consumer credit data for February. The Yankees, Phillies, and Twins host their home openers. And happy birthday, Lady Day. Billie Holiday was born on this day in 1915. She would have been 99. God bless the child that's got his own, people. I'm Millie Jefferson.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's been 100 years since Henry Ford invented the world's first assembly line. And that set in motion a whole bunch of things. Cars became more affordable, workers flocked to Detroit, and we got interstates. And all that helped strengthen the economic fabric of America. Ford is still around, of course, but who's the typical 21st century auto worker? Increasingly, he or she is Chinese, assembling cars in China that'll be sold to Chinese customers.
As Marketplace's Rob Schmitz reports from Shanghai, China is proving to be a lucrative place for American automakers, but one that's also challenging.
At the end of Ford's assembly line in Chongqing, plant manager Greg Brown is counting cars.
We stand here for an hour, we should count 63 cars going by here. Remember, we're scheduled to build 1,281 vehicles today.
Ford sold its first passenger car in China in 2003. Last year, it sold close to a million. Most of them are assembled here in the southwestern Chinese metropolis of Chongqing. This is Ford's largest manufacturing hub outside Michigan. It's a joint venture with Chinese automaker Chang'an. Scott Chang is a spokesman for Ford.
Looking at China today in Chongqing, we're in a fantastic spot because the growing auto market is out here in the middle and in the west, and so being in Chongqing gives us a great advantage.
Another advantage? A near-endless supply of cheap labor. The Chongqing region is home to low wages and tens of millions of farmers eager to make more money at a factory close to home. Meet the 21st century auto worker.
My name is Liu Chan. I work at the final stage of the assembly line, making adjustments to the vehicles coming off the line.
Liu says he works 8 hours a day. He has two kids, he owns a Ford Focus, and his wife works here too. Ford has handpicked Liu to speak to me, and managers won't let him discuss salary, overtime rate, no numbers. But this is Marketplace, I say. We do the numbers. Nope, says Ford. Those numbers are secret. So after my day at Ford is through, I stick around outside the factory gates, and without the looming presence of Ford management, other workers help me do the numbers.
My base salary is higher than average, a little over 1,800 yuan a month.
That's equal to $1.80 an hour. Xu works on the assembly line. He shows me his Ford ID badge, but he doesn't want his full name used. Xu says with overtime and bonuses, he makes around $10,000 a year, enough to buy a modest apartment nearby for his wife, child, and his wife's parents. He feels lucky to have this job.
The workload is very demanding, hours are long, and it's very tiring. But my salary is very high compared to work in any other factory around here.
Xu says getting a job at Ford is so competitive that some people resort to bribing employees in Ford's HR department just to secure a position at the plant.
It's pretty common for the most coveted jobs at the company, like the quality control department. They usually have to pay between 3,000 to 5,000 yuan.
That's about $500 to $900.
If you're a woman, it'll cost you more than double that.
Xu says that's because women are generally looking for less labor-intensive administrative roles. Xu says paying for positions at Ford was common a few years ago, but lately it's less so because of the increasing amount of overtime required to keep up with demand.
I know one person who paid 5,000 yuan to get a job here, but then he was assigned to work in the welding workshop, a really tough job, and he wanted to quit, but he had to stick around to earn back the bribe he had paid.
Xu says Ford management has made it clear that bribery is illegal, and if they knew about this, they'd try to put a stop to it. But
there's a Chinese saying, there are rules that come from above, and there are solutions down here on the ground.
And Ford may not be alone. Marketplace discovered online posts in China by job seekers and middlemen that indicated they could buy coveted jobs inside other foreign automakers like Volkswagen and General Motors. Another Ford worker named Wang, who also didn't want to give his full name, says, yeah, he knows people at Ford who paid bribes for their jobs. He says this isn't a Ford problem. It's a China problem.
You might not do this sort of thing in the U.S., but here in China, bribing someone to get something you want is completely normal and inevitable.
Not all of the Ford workers I spoke to in Chongqing talked about others who had paid for positions at the plant. Several assembly line workers said they had never heard of such a thing. In a written statement to Marketplace, Ford said, "We take these allegations very seriously and have initiated an investigation. Any behavior that violates our policies, such as the alleged behavior, would result in immediate dismissal." James McGregor is author of 1 Billion Customers, Lessons from the Front Lines of Doing Business in China. He says it usually takes foreign companies years to get used to the scale of corruption in China.
Everything you do, every transaction, every deal, every move, every permit, there's just so many interfaces with the government.
And at every step, says McGregor, somebody's taking money.
So when you get into the private companies, of course, that culture will infect it.
McGregor's advice for foreign companies who find this sort of corruption inside their China operation? Don't be soft.
you should fire people and you should do it very publicly and you should turn them over to the police authorities. Unfortunately, what happens in foreign companies a lot is they'll investigate corruption and then they'll quietly pay the people off to go away and inflict some other company because they don't want the embarrassment.
Another challenge for companies like Ford is they're required by Chinese law to partner with a Chinese company. Ford's Chongqing plant is a 50-50 joint venture with Chang'an, one of China's big four automakers. Often, Chinese partners bring their own corporate culture to the mix, which can include practices like taking bribes. Ford employee Xu says many of his colleagues at Chongqing's Ford plant came from one of the plants owned by the Chinese partner. He says the benefits and pay at Ford are much better. And Xu says, lucky for him, he didn't have to pay to get a job he liked. In Chongqing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
See what the Ford plant Rob visited looks like, plus compare the wages of Chinese auto workers with U.S. workers at marketplace.org. If you can remember the last time you ate at a Hard Rock Cafe. Well, for me, it's been a while, but apparently I'm an outlier because it turns out the Hard Rock Cafe, which was founded more than four decades ago, is actually growing. Vanessa Wong is a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek, and she recently took a look at what's given the chain such staying power. Hey, Vanessa.
Hey, David.
So there is a Hard Rock Cafe in downtown D.C. where I live, and I walk by it from time to time, and I'm struck by what I see there, and that is just masses of middle school students and parent chaperones. It strikes me that that seems like its main clientele. Am I wrong about that?
No, you are totally right. The Hard Rock Cafe works very closely with school groups and tour groups. And I recently went to the Hard Rock Cafe in Times Square, and it was the same deal. And that's like a gigantic restaurant. I think it seats more than 700 people.
Wow.
And anyone there older than 12 was ancient. So,
you know, not too long ago, I guess this used to be a thing, right? Like theme restaurants were a big deal. There was the Hard Rock Cafe. There was Planet Hollywood. These were everywhere.
Yeah, there was a giant boom in the theme restaurant concept in the 90s. And they blame some of their outdated image on kind of like the proliferation of the theme restaurant and say that at some point, you know, consumers just couldn't even tell the difference between a Hard Rock and a Planet Hollywood, which is something they found very offensive. So now Planet Hollywood is down to, you know, fewer than 10 restaurants.
Wow. That few.
Yeah, competition from Planet Hollywood has fallen away. And so they think that in terms of the theme restaurant market, they're really poised to rule.
Who owns the Hard Rock Cafe chain? Is it owned by musicians or Hollywood entertainment types? I mean, who owns this place?
So the Hard Rock Cafe is actually owned by the Seminole Tribe of Florida, who bought the company in 2007 from their previous owner, Rank, which sold the Hard Rock when sales were slipping so that they could focus instead on their casino business, which is interesting because Hard Rock Cafe ended up, you know, building its casino business after that anyway.
And there's been a lot of growth, right? I mean, the casinos, the hotels, they've been expanding all around the world.
Exactly. So they've opened their first hotel and casino in Las Vegas in 1995. And now the company has 19 hotels and 9 casinos around the world. And they're opening 6 more. There's a new casino coming in Hungary. And the casinos are, of course, a big profit driver for the company. So they're hoping that they can keep people interested in the Hard Rock brand more generally by, you know, keeping them at their hotels, you know, in their 20s and 30s, and then in their older years to come to the casinos.
So I wonder if you think that this strategy is going to work. In other words, is Hard Rock Cafe going to be able to broaden its appeal and get folks who aren't middle school students and their parents into their restaurants?
I think that as long as they offer tourists a good enough experience while they're there, they're probably likely to visit another Hard Rock at another location the next time they're traveling to a place where it's hard to find a good hamburger.
Vanessa Wong's a reporter for Bloomberg Businessweek. You can find a link to her piece about Hard Rock Cafe on our website, marketplace.org. Thanks, Vanessa.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note, the men's basketball Final Four is this weekend. Tomorrow, the Wisconsin Badgers take on the Kentucky Wildcats, and the Florida Gators play the UConn Huskies. UConn's women's team is also in the running for national championship, by the way. It's a big week for the university in Storrs, Connecticut, because these games coincide with a major bond offering. It's selling $220 million worth of bonds to fund campus construction. And according to Bloomberg, some bond buyers hope this might lead to some good seats at this weekend's games. Well, sorry, the school says that is not going to happen. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow dropped 159 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ slashed 110 points, 2.6%. And the S&P 500 cut 23 points, 1.25%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm David Gura, headed back to D.C. tonight. Kai Ryssdal is back on Monday. Have a great weekend, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.